Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're actually going to the reaction we've had to a podcast that we only put out this morning. But before we get there, Martin, a lot going on.
Yeah, well, is there, isn't there, Tony? We knew he was going to get away with that because of the numbers in the Doyle last night. Does it make them look good? No, they look awful.
No, but that's what I suppose what I mean when I say a lot going on. What I mean is the horrible rhetoric that stop saying Donald Trump's name all the time. You know, it's just been absolutely cheesy. I mean, there's attack ads constantly. There's, you know, the personalizing of these things, and it's gotten really, really, really shitty.
It's gotten really, really Trumpy, Tony.
Yeah, but why should we use that? Like, I mean, why should we give him
who's using it, Tony?
They all are. They all are. Like, Leo was accused of using the Trumpian defense, and then Simon Harris accused the opposition of importing Trump style politics. They all are, Martin. It's not just one side. I don't want to be both sides in it. One side, in my mind, is definitely worse because they're not dealing with the substantive issue of the fact that he leaked a confidential agreement.
I know that.
Bollocks of everything it comes down to on a scale of one to Donald Trump, how bad are you? It's just nonsense. We have to be better than that.
It is. It is nonsense, Tony. It's complete. And it's distraction. It's just distraction. It's a refusal to be held accountable. It's now pantomime. You can't ask Fine Gael a question without them shouting Bobby's story. And those of us who are actually interested in politics I find this very frustrating, and we can't see the point in it. Can't see the point in it.
I absolutely can't see where any constructive dialogue happens, where you can pass legislation, where you can do anything when they want to decide that everything is just between us versus them, and it's tribal and it's ugly, and they're accusing people of the very thing that they're doing all the time.
Is that not the Orwellian thing, Tony? Just get out there and accuse them first of what you're doing.
Well, no, it goes back to Cicero. If you've no legal argument, attack the plaintiff, and hopefully that'll just distract enough from the shit you've been pulling. And that's what's going on now. There was no legal basis for what the Taoiseach, the then Taoiseach, did, so they attacked the people who were accusing him. And like, you get to the point where, you know, don't make me stand up for Village Magazine, don't make me stand up for Sinn Féin and Paul Murphy, don't make me stand up for these people.
But you're not standing up. All you're saying is, look, the line is terribly clear, it's right or it's wrong. There's no justification for doing it. You might have a mitigating circumstance after you do it. Okay, I'll give you that. You might have a mitigating circumstance, but that doesn't detract from what you did. You must take responsibility for it.
Well, the other ugly thing that happened, and it falls into a behavior pattern that we're seeing in the Taoiseach now, which is actually a really, in my mind, a character flaw. You know, you think about the day he threw the chief medical officer, Tony Hullin, under the bus. Well, stabbed him, literally. Stabbed him is too strong, but he absolutely went for him on national TV. Then a week later, he rode back with the whole, you know, when he did first of all say, I'm not in the business of apologizing. But then he said, you know, we're going to look at this and the cabinet are going to do this. And he did the same thing the other night where he stood up and he said, here's my version of events. And Matthew O'Toole is not my friend. He's a friend, but he's not my friend. And he threw him under the bus, and he had people come around and drive the bus over him, reverse it back and do all of these things as they say. And then he turned around yesterday and he went, well, actually, Matthew O'Toole is blameless. I did it. And it's this ugly reversal of when the damage is already done.
Yeah, but then I said it before, Tony, the Gaelers have like a 7-day memory. They forget everything from 7 days ago.
Not just the Gaelers. Unfortunately, the general public are too busy. It's only nerds like you or me. I mean, I saw it today, which was hilarious. I don't know if you've seen it. The latest attack ad is about Sinn Féin's questionable They got 4 million from a person who passed away and that is questionable. It has to. It's right to ask
why,
questions.
Why? Okay.
No,
but it was all above board, Tony.
That's not the point. The point is, if you want politics to be transparent and equal, Martin, you have to have it transparent and equal for all. Okay. So it is right to ask questions. However, I think it's hilarious that they turn around on the flip side to make another attack video and they use Barry Ward to say, "I'm putting Trump forward this legislation that will make them have to give back this 4 million. And Barry Ward is the same guy who, when he was Dublin City Councillor, availed of grants that SIPO had to look into for his education process. That he was, you know, there was suggestions, allegations of financial irregularities or using of loopholes to pay for a college through Trinity while he was availing of Dublin City Council salary and as a sitting councillor. So, I mean, they must think people don't remember what happened, like, never mind, like, last week.
But they don't.
But again, nor do they care.
That
hypocrisy is everywhere. Because if you've got to play that front, you have to remember, you know...
But whose dinner are Fine Gael eating, Tony?
Fine Gael's. That's the dumbest thing. Yeah.
That's the problem. Fianna Fáil can't see that they are being eaten. Sinn Féin aren't losing votes.
No.
Fine Gael aren't losing votes. The Greens are going to be eaten and Fianna Fáil are going to be eaten. And we're all sitting there going, why are you doing this? It's pure madness that you're doing this, but why are you doing it? Just, you know, for interest's sake, why are you doing it?
No, they don't. They're absolutely outflanked on all sides, and they're like people forget that. I know Sinn Féin will tell you they got the biggest vote in the last election, but Fianna Fáil got the most seats.
They are
absolutely the third wheel. Nearly, you know, they've become the third wheel.
Well, they've become. Micheál Martin is so insignificant. I mean, he is literally so insignificant. You know, even at press conferences, nobody really cares what Micheál has to say. And he's the Taoiseach. And even he refers to the Tánaiste as Taoiseach. I mean, it's a muddle. It's a mess. We're lacking in leadership. The country feels that way. It's certainly not senior hurling, Tony.
No, it's not senior hurling. And, you know, it's look, I don't want to just dunk on the Greens for the day because they've done enough dunking on themselves. They've done enough dunking on themselves to show that they're actually almost at that stage where you can really forget about them because they've become so irrelevant.
Already did, Tony.
Yeah. But what I will add is, if you're listening to this, guys, us two Egypts do this stuff regularly on patreon.com/tortoiseshack for our members, and it goes out to members only. So if you're not a member, you won't be hearing these crazy hot takes that make us make your blood boil, which is probably a good thing. This is not really me selling it very well, Martin, am I not?
No. Well, I'll tell you what. An old school buddy tuned into the Tortoiseshack for the first time today. And the first podcast he listened to was Noel McGree, the whistleblower, and he was blown away by the podcast. So I love that. That's a great first day for somebody to come on the podcast and listen to.
Before we move on, and again, patreon.com/tortoiseshack, please help us out. It's a ton of work here. And trust me, I'm going to be at this about 10 o'clock tonight. Thanks, Rory. But at the same time, you know, the Seamus Wolf situation is obviously going to be a huge embarrassment for the government now as well. And it's a rod for their own back because, let's tell the truth, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been in power for 1,000 years and they've never done anything about how you fix this situation. And they're now left with a situation whereby a judge has been told by the senior counsel that he should resign, and it's very public. They published all the letters. Judge Susan Denham, when she interviewed him, all of that's in the public record. So we know that he was willing to apologise. And we had Aoife Moore on the pod on Sunday, on the live pod, and she said that there was going to be a public apology. It's known that Seamus Wolf had agreed to give the public apology, but because of his answers to the questions, whereby he more or less it says, "I'm apologising, but I don't really know what I'm apologising for." What's been said now is that ultimately your apology won't mean anything because you still don't really think you did anything wrong.
Yeah.
And they're right to point that out because everybody knows he has still, I mean, used terms like the KKK were used. Like crazy stuff were used and accused journalists of, you know, going after heads and taking people out. Like, that's just not the case. again, I saw people talk about the fact that as the AG, he did a lot of good work in terms of standing up for the repeal movement and all of this kind of liberal woke stuff that we're all championing here all the time. But nonetheless, I mean, you can't go on like that. And I think the senior counsel is right. If you're going to apologize and then say, well, I actually don't know what I'm apologizing for, what good is your apology?
Well, I thought the bit that I thought was most interesting is that he was willing to sanction himself. And I thought to myself, you know, that's neck. There's a brass neck to that that's just unreal. But it's no less of a brass neck that exists in the Doyle at the present moment in time, Tony. And if you were to ask me, the Chief Justice showed far more backbone and integrity by saying, this is the line you do not cross in the Supreme Court, because we won't work with you if you do. And I thought that was very telling. At least one arm of our dysfunctional state is trying to function, and that's hopeful.
We don't know where this is really going. Will the government move to impeach him? They might have to. Have they got grounds to? They probably don't, you know, because they haven't got the laws just aren't in place to do this. So
our friend has a great piece in the Sunday Business Post on it today. Jennifer Kavanagh. Is it Jennifer Kavanagh?
The constitutional lawyer.
Yeah, she is a great
lecturer.
And goddess where these things are concerned. And she said she agrees with you. It's going to be very hard to stick anything on him. But what it will do is the system will now change. And for a system that doesn't change, you know, it thinks in decades rather than in months. At least that's something.
But you know what's funny about this? I know he was a pain in the hole, and you know you wouldn't want him anywhere near government ever again. But Shane Ross always fought on the basis that the judiciary needed so much reform. He was always right about that.
Yeah, well, it's been you're not allowed to criticize the judiciary, but that's wrong. You must be allowed to criticize the judiciary.
But even if you recall when the global financial crisis hit and Ireland fell into rack and ruin, and the IMF and the ECB and the Troika arrived in to tell us what we needed to do, they also said we needed to look at the legal system and how, you know, and it never happened. Everybody just went, shh, wait until they're gone. reform never happened.
They were actually so resistant to reform, Tony, utterly resistant to reform. So, you know, any reform of the judiciary is good. Which needs more reform now is the question, the judiciary or the Doyle? I think the Doyle actually needs more reform now.
The problem in the Dáil, as you can see now, when you see this that vote last night, is, as I pointed out and we've pointed out repeatedly on this podcast, they have a super majority. That's what they have.
Yeah,
and they I mean, you see the ragtag of independence, you know, you have people with convictions against them, you have racists, and you have people who are warning that children are gonna join ISIS, and they're voting with the government. So you know, that's who you're voting with, guys. You're voting with them people. So,
Suicide Squad, tell me.
That's it. The very last thing I'll talk about, you nutter. Allegedly. The very last thing I'll talk about is the leaders' questions today on housing. Because, you know, we've spoken to Dara O'Brien. We've had him on a couple of times. He's now Minister for Housing. We see the plan we're supposed to be bringing forward, supposed to be available from September. Again, there's just no radical thinking in it. And this is not me saying that Owen O'Brien has the answer to everything. This is me, you know, with years of experience in how the financial services work around housing. And you know this, Martin, they just have no innovative thinking other than let's get it. Maybe instead of just 10% from the private developers, we may be able to pay them an extra to get 20%, and the developer still makes out like a bandit. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, and you've got to ask, like, I'm asking a lot of questions recently about people's rationale for doing things, Tony, and I keep asking, what is their rationale for doing this? And then I see how easily they can be influenced, you know, that complete strangers can influence them to do things. And I'm like, really, that's it? If you pander to their egos it's more likely that you'll get them to do what they want. So I'm quite sure that's what all these lobbyists do. They go in there and they back clap and tell them what a great job they're doing, and they got to keep doing more of the great job they're doing. But the great job is shit.
I think there's a bit of that. And I think there's just, there's also politicians respond to public pressure. Okay. And Orla, if you go back to the podcast, and I'd recommend listeners go back and listen to the one we just did on the housing situation and how to fix it, because Orla Hegarty referred to the dishonesty that is in the debate about housing that we never talk about. And Martin, it's actually about people like you and me who sit here having in our houses that we own, and it suits us that our house is worth X amount of money. And by definition, that house is unaffordable. It suits us, you know, in that. And to vote for people who would actually, in theory, deflate that bubble or put an actual baseline that it won't fall below by increasing the stock of public and mixed and affordable housing, we'd be voting against our own interests. And there's an element of dishonesty in the Irish electorate that says, at the end of the day, kind of feel better that my house is worth 400,000 or 300,000 or whatever it is than I did when I thought actually everything is shitty when you know we went back to it, the arse fell out of the market. But the only problem is that's been proven to be wrong. It's going to fall out of it again because bubbles burst.
Yeah. Look, I feel very sorry for anybody who's in the last year has bought a house. Well, it won't be this last year. I mean, 2019, there won't have many shifted since. But I do feel sorry for them, because sooner or later they're going to be in negative equity, and it's this game that's played over and over and over again. My house was never about the value of it, Tony. It was about the security of a roof over my head. And I was able to get a house back in 1999 working as a motorcycle courier. Now, you tell me that could happen today. It couldn't happen today. So something has gone very awry. I was able to do it. And I worked my arse off for it and struggled and sat on cardboard boxes and, you know, didn't go on a holiday for a decade and everything that goes with it. But I could do it. But it is simply unachievable for so many people. And that's what's wrong.
Yeah, no. Like, I mean, the answer to my own question is, yes, okay, Tony, you are very happy that your house is going up in value, but would you like to see your children grow up and have a home of their own in the future? Would you like them to actually be close enough that you don't have to see them over fucking Zoom going forward? I'd very much like that. Thank you very much. But the way things are going, the way we build the model,
we've got to stop saying we too, Tony. We don't. We advocate for something better.
Absolutely, we do. But again, have to be very fair that the electorate don't. And that's the truth. You know, the electorate haven't. And they I just think at the moment they just don't know what they want. But they need to be shown different. You know, everything is impossible until it's done, Martin. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. When people think these, and the funny thing is, the things that we're told are impossible here have already been done in Vienna and in Stockholm and these places. You know, they're actually coming, they're 30 years into it where they're getting irritated about it, you know? It's like private industries moving in going, actually, we'd like a slice of your public model. Thank you very much. Can we take over the management of your properties? That stuff, like, we're decades behind all of that, you know? Look, we're going to leave it there. There's an interview coming up. Martin, do you want to just give people a very, very brief insight in what you just recorded? Very brief.
Okay. I spoke to Antoinette Delaney McGree, and Antoinette is the husband of Noel. And Tony, the wife of Noel. And Tony and I spoke to Noel this week. I've been talking to Noel for quite a while now, and Noel is a whistleblower from the prison service. And it's very rare we get to hear how it affects the family. And I asked Antoinette to talk to us just to give us a sense of how much it has affected her and the kids. And I think this is a real must listen to, Tony. I really do, for everybody. Hello and welcome to the Tortoise Shack. Today I'm going to be talking to Antoinette McGree. Antoinette, you're married to Noel, and we spoke to Noel on the podcast last week. He's a prison officer. He's a whistleblower. And he's had a really rough time of it. You've picked up the pieces. What has it been like, Antoinette?
It's been pretty horrendous, to be honest. I married Noel in 98. We were both living in Dublin at the time, working in Dublin, enjoyed all the trappings of life in Dublin. And we moved to Portlaoise in 2000. And we had our two boys. I stayed home mum with the boys. Noel was working, everything was fine. And I suppose it would have been around 2012, I would have noticed Noel getting very quiet and kind of very subdued. He would have insisted on walking home from work rather than me collecting him, you know, just because he just wanted to walk home. And maybe just, I didn't really realize it, just said, oh, you know, he wants a bit of space or whatever. But then coming up 2012, 2013 into 2014, it was kind of pretty evident, you know, that there was a problem, and his personality had changed. He would be very tense, and he eventually, I suppose, kind of broke down and told me some of the stuff that had been going on. He was trying to shield us from it. So I suppose from then, from 2013 initially, then, like, basically he was picked out of the catering section in the prison, and he took that pretty bad because it was a position that he enjoyed, and he actually, you know, he was getting great satisfaction from helping prisoners and that while doing that job. And of course it was a bonus because he was able to cook for us then when he came home as well. It was a double whammy that he was able to cook. But it just,
and he'd been a prison officer for a very long time, Antoinette. He'd been, you know, it was his career.
Yes, he was 4 years when we would have been, we got married, like I said, in 98. He was a prison officer 4 years at that time. I would have known him for all his career. It was a job he enjoyed and he loved. And of course, with prison in that time, the social life, you know, was good. The camaraderie is great with prison officers and families. And, you know, there was always a great support system there. But unfortunately, that just went pear-shaped because the lack of support just stopped because, you know, people would cross the street. They wouldn't talk to you. You know, we would have been there for weddings, births, funerals with all these people. And it's getting to the stage now, these people would shout abuse at me when I'm going into the shop to get a sliced pan. And, you know, it's pretty horrendous, you know.
And it is a prison town, you know, that's fair enough to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's two of the biggest prisons in the country, being Portlaoise complex, and then the new Midlands complex was built. So invariably you throw a stick, you're bound to meet a prison officer, a wife, a cousin, an aunt. There's somebody, you know. So it would have been, you know, we would have grown up with them in Portlaoise then, you know, throughout our children's early years in school then as well. So and we would have had a good support.
Do you think there was an omerta involved that, you know, once you've spoken out, then you're outside the loop for as far as that concerned?
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, we would have attended, you know, social events. You know, we would have been there for people when they were, like I said, funerals, stuff like that. And, you know, it just became toxic. There's no other words about it. The whole situation is just pure toxic. I mean, when you have to time when you can go to the shop to get a sliced pan, you know, for your kids' lunch the next morning for school, it's pretty bad. I mean, we would not venture out of the house. Say, I dropped the kids to school for 8:45, and between 8 and 9 o'clock, you literally would want to be back at the house because obviously they're going to work 10 to 8. Between 12:30 and 2 o'clock is just a total no-go in Portlaoise because you have every prison officer out and about, walking, shopping, whatever. And then again in the evening. And then, of course, you have, you know, you go to your local supermarket, you go to your local shopping centre. There isn't a day goes by where you don't meet somebody who's connected to the prison or who doesn't have a go with you or isn't passing snide comments at, you know, at you or that.
And do you feel like a prisoner in your own town?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, people laugh, like I've had my elderly parents in the car and I might go around the roundabout a second time and I'm saying, oh, sorry, I forgot to get something. And it's just pure, you're on high alert constantly because you're watching, you know, if somebody is following you. I was followed home recently from soccer. A car came in, followed me literally a 3-mile journey home from the soccer pitch. pulled right up to my house, had full lights on, and I actually did. I got out of the car and I went towards the car, and it just did a donut and just drove away. The house has been egged. We've had a rat left on the doorstep. I mean, Noel would have to go out in the morning before the kids would leave for school just to check around the house to make sure it was okay.
What has the effect been, firstly on Noel and then on you and the kids, Antoinette?
I suppose the big word in the house that we've all come to learn with is no. I mean, the kids, it's very hard. We have two young boys. They're, you know, they're at that age. They want to be sociable and they wanted to go out. And I mean, they, you know, play dates would have been curtailed. They wouldn't have been involved in that many outdoor activities unless, say, Noel and I could have attended both together. I mean, for, you know, a lot of our friends, you know, saying in primary school and stuff like that, people would say to us, oh my God, you're always together. You're such a lovely family. You're always, when you see one of you, you see the four of you. But that would purely be because you were safe in numbers. And I wouldn't go to the school on my own. Noel would sit in the car with me or vice versa. And you wouldn't dare leave the kids here to run to the shop. You'd have to get them into the car to bring with you. And when you have teenage kids that want to play Xbox like most boys do, you know, that can be hard. And you know, when they're asking for things, everyday things, like, you know, just to buy something, you know, for money and stuff like that, all that. I mean, we had a very scary scenario. Well, it was horrendous. It was my son's 11th birthday, and I went to Aldi to do a shop. We were going to have some friends around for a party, and got to check out in Aldi, and the card was declined. And I rang Noel, spoke to Noel, and he said he was in work at the time, and he said, you know, I don't know. He said, look, leave it there, go home, and I'll sort it out. And we had discovered he hadn't received pay. He would have got paid every fortnight on the Thursday. And yet again, it would have been a previous fortnight he wouldn't have been paid. So we'd have had to go without. We would have had to go through the whole rigmarole of trying to get the money, try and get some money back. And it would be, oh, it was an error, it was an accident. And unfortunately, it just happened to be you again. And that particular day after the party, we managed to have a few friends in. We gathered together a few bits and they were kicking ball in the front lawn. And when they left, my son, he said, we could have his birthday money if we needed it to pay bills. And I mean, that's heartbreaking, you know, for...
And that abuse has gone on. That financial abuse has gone. Even though Noel is now retired out of the prison service, the financial abuse has continued. Am I right about that?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because as you can imagine, he's been retired early, extremely early. So he's on a totally reduced pension. My health has suffered hugely. So we would have had huge medical bills, which we would have had a medical aid that would have been paid for, you know, through Noel's wages and that. But that obviously was stopped because when Noel's paycheck wasn't going in, the contributions weren't being paid. So you'd turn up for a medical appointment and you'd give your details. And when they put it through, they wouldn't see you because the subs wouldn't have been paid to the medical insurance. And I'm on quite a lot. I suffered two strokes as a result of the stress, and I was without medication. And basically, you know, in order... it was feed the kids or take my medication. So I would drop them to school, come home. I'd go to bed for the afternoon, for the morning, and get up and then start again. But just to kind of try and, you know, bed rest, try and monitor myself, because I couldn't afford the medication, the blood pressure medication and stuff that I was on. I have a skin complaint that entails that I have to take, I'm on actually 8 antibiotics a day alone just for a skin complaint, because I continuously scratch all the time. At night I'd wake up and the whole place I would just be covered. I'm totally scarred on my arms and my legs and my body just from pure, it's just irritation. So yeah, you know, it's taken a huge toll. Absolutely, it's, you know, it's changed our life. And you know, people say about COVID and restrictions, and it's second nature to us. I mean, we've been level five to us has been like since 2014. We've lived under level five restrictions and we still are. And even the 1st of December, that won't change for us, you know, because we don't go out. I couldn't remember the last time we've attended a social event. We just don't. We can't. And,
and you've written to the Taoiseach. And you've also written to, who else have you written to?
I wrote to Charlie Flanagan. I called to speak to Charlie Flanagan because not only was he Minister for Justice at the time, he was our public representative. And not as a whistleblower's wife, I went down as a mother. I was in a very, very bad state that particular day. I went down and I was seated in his secretary's office and asked to wait. And I heard a door bang, and when I stood up and looked out, he had left the building by the back door and refused to talk to me.
That was very nice of him, I have to say.
I wrote to him to put it into writing how I felt. He had made a statement on the 6-1 News that what had happened to Maurice McCabe would never happen again. And I mean, it was just pure disbelief. I was sitting watching this and I was fuming, you know. I mean, it is happening and it was happening. And I got a stock answer back. Well, you know, I can't talk to you. It's your husband's situation. You're only his wife. And he wouldn't talk to me. I referred the matter. I wrote to Micheál Martin again. He passed it on to Helen McAtee. I sent a very, very personal letter to Helen McAtee privately to her. To date, just shortly July, just after she got the Justice Department portfolio, and to date I have never received a reply. Not even an acknowledgement to say this letter has been seen or nothing. Absolutely nothing.
And the abuse continues. You've had abuse very recently.
Yes, as late as last Saturday night, at 9:30 last Saturday night, our house was egged. I'm on my third car wash. I have to try and get company in. We have our house, front of our house, totally destroyed with eggs, granite, windowsills, everything totally destroyed with eggs that were thrown at the house. It's under guard. It was four guys. It's under guard of investigation at the moment. So they're looking into it, and you know, they're taking it quite serious. But there was a lot of damage done, and that would have been the fourth time that had happened. I've obviously, the summer we did have some good weather. Our house is based in a cul-de-sac, so nobody really has to pass our house. If people call to our house, it's kind of they're coming to see us, or you know, maybe they're lost. But I mean, the amount of people that would pass, come down and just literally stand in our driveway and take a photograph of our house and walk away, or shout abuse when they'd be walking up the Dublin Road on their lunch break. Like, it's, you know, it's a daily occurrence, you know, and it's something that I can't see an end to it. You know, it's,
Can I ask you, it's been very, very tough on you and the kids. Has it been very tough on Noel?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, he has a huge amount of guilt, you know, and I suppose it could have broken us, but it didn't. We kind of, if anything, we kind of got a bit stronger with it because, you know, we moved to Fort Laois, like I said, in 2000. We're not originally from Laois, so we were always blowing. So we wouldn't have had a huge family around us. Our family would have been spread around. But that whole, you know, it's just us. It's the four of us against the world is what it feels like, you know, because you know, there's very few. I'd have a couple. I'd say I could probably pick two wives that I could pick up the phone and talk to if I needed to talk to. But that would be privately. You know, a lot of people don't want to be seen publicly to support you, or, you know, they'll smile maybe if there's somebody else around or something like that. But it is only just for a public persona. You know, in private, these people would, I suppose, it's a terrible thing to say, but they'd literally stab you in the back. Like, they just, you know, it's frightening.
Can I ask you one last question?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think Noel did the right thing? And do you think you would let him do it again, or you would support him if he did it again?
Well, initially, yes, 100% he did the right thing. I mean, he only ever wanted to do what was right. It was never about getting anyone in trouble. It was health and safety. It was, you know, it was just day-to-day issues that he felt were wrong, that shouldn't have been happening, and he decided to speak up. And I fully supported him on that. But I mean, as a mother and a wife, as a sister, it's horrendous to say that I would just tell somebody, keep your mouth shut and just walk away. I mean, I've said it time again, if you witness something in it, just I wouldn't report it, and I wouldn't recommend anybody speak up. Because, and like, it's not a good lesson for my children, but we have warned our kids, and I have on a daily basis, keep your head down, just don't say anything, don't get involved, just keep your mouth shut. And you know, it's scary for them because they're young boys, they want to go out in the world, but unfortunately it's a small town, it's a small island. Like, you know, it's scary that you're telling them do your best, you know, because initially eventually you're probably just going to have to pack your bags and get in the plane and get out of here, because you know, that's the scary fact of it. You know, there's no support. There's absolutely no support from people, and from, you know, from people in higher, you know,
office. Yeah,
a higher office. Yes, exactly.
Antoinette, thank you very much for taking the time to have a chat with me. I can see how deeply this affects you, and I hope that we can help in whatever way we can. And thank you.
Thank
again.
You. And I mean, you know, Twitter is a strange place. It's not something I'm used to, but I mean, the support from strangers, I mean, I don't think anyone will ever realize what it means to us, you know, because like I said, people you've known all your life will cross the street, but you have, like, we've had strangers with tweeted every day with support, and that just means, you know, it means the world, you know, that there is people out there that are actually good and do care about you, you know. So that's one I suppose good thing that comes out of it. I hope eventually at some stage you get to meet some of these people, but you know, it is great that there is support out there.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, that was really something, Tony. It leaves me speechless. You okay?
Difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I hope the right people are listening, Tony.
I just, like, you know, because we hear these stories and they're vague and you can put them down. But when you put the voice behind them, that's what matters. You know, when you hear the voice behind it, the person telling their story about their family, and, you know, you'd want to have a heart of stone, not to.
Yeah, I think the current Minister for Justice needs to step up now, Tony. I think that's it. Just needs to step up and nip this situation before it gets any worse.
I think it also sends a message again in this country that too often, time and time again, we let whistleblowers down.
Oh yeah, hugely, hugely. Look, I'd just like to remind everybody, we couldn't do this work without patrons. We just simply couldn't.
No, we can't.
I'm after spending a lot of time talking to Noel over the last few weeks, and we wouldn't be able to do this. And this work needs to be done. These stories need to be told. There is no doubt about it. So please come along, join us as patrons, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And for the price of a cup of coffee, you can help support this kind of work. And it is really good work to do. I feel great about doing it, Tony.
Yeah, no, and you know, it's always the work that keeps us coming back, because it certainly isn't the money, I can tell you. But again, share that, please. Tell people about it, introduce them to the Tortoise Shack. We have a lot of stuff that we've a lot of people that we're delighted to work with, and the wider Tortoise Shack itself is doing phenomenal work. We just happen to be the lucky guys that got a start on it.
Yeah.
Talk to you all soon, folks. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.